Grace, the Amy Santiago of Royal Bloggers.
And I'm Jessica, the Dorothy Sporanath of Royal Bloggers.
And we'd like to welcome you to On Air, the podcast where two cynical Brits discuss the latest royal news and the truth behind the stories. And welcome to this week's episode of the On Air podcast. I hope you enjoyed last week's episode. But this week we are pivoting back to more familiar territory with an entirely British week, pretty much. But we thought we would start with a nice, positive story, which is the birth of a new royal baby. Mm-hmm. Because earlier this week, Buckingham Palace announced that Princess Eugenie of York had a new baby, her second son, and gave us lots of information about his name, which is a very intriguing one.
The confirmation was on the 5th of June, I think, but the baby was born on the 30th of May. And just in case you don't know, Princess Eugenie, I'm just mostly thinking of my mother who doesn't know who any of these people are, but listens every week. Princess Eugenie is the granddaughter of the late Queen through Prince Andrew and Sarah Ferguson. So there you go. I think before I get into any of the actual like announcement stuff, is it just me who keeps forgetting she was pregnant?
No, because I kept seeing pictures of her looking very, very pregnant. And then I kept seeing stories like, ooh, Beatrice has just been spotted carrying a new baby balloon. And I was like, oh, she must be having the baby. And then we'd see her again the next day, like, very, very pregnant.
Yeah.
So, it's like, when is this baby coming?
I was trying to think about it. I don't know whether it's just because there's been a lot of stuff going on or maybe we have seen her less. I really don't know. But I kept forgetting about it over and over again. And then when she had the baby, I was trying to think like, okay, well, she must have been heavily pregnant at the coronation. And I was trying to think like, what did she wear? And I honestly cannot remember her even being at the coronation. I don't know. Did you ever watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
Yes.
You know, so the character of Dawn, who shows up in like the fourth or fifth season, and she's Buffy's sister. And we've had like four seasons of this with Buffy having no sister. And at the beginning, you're like, where is this character who's just come from that everybody acknowledges and says has been here the whole time? And like, I don't remember them. Did they just invent a sister? That's kind of what it feels like, is like, they just invented that Eugenie was having a baby 5 minutes ago and they implanted this memory in all of us. But there's still a little bit in the back of my head that's like, no, she wasn't. This is all made up. They've just fabricated this. That's what it feels like to me, that like, as if there's just been some giant mind trick that's been played on everyone, that they've just invented this pregnancy and has put it all in our memories. That's not a real conspiracy theory before people start. Because you know, with the royals, the conspiracy theories.
I really hope that becomes a fully fledged conspiracy.
The British royal family put a mind chip in us, and we all thought somebody that most people don't even know is pregnant. but yeah, no, I don't know if it's because we've had a lot of, you know, babies over the years, or if it's the fact that the Queen died and the coronation happened and that was the focus for everything for a while, or maybe she really hasn't been outside very often compared to previous things. But yeah, personally, I just, before we even get into any of the actual stuff that happened, I had entirely forgotten that she was pregnant.
I think I knew she was pregnant. I think it's only because I kept seeing paparazzi photos of her very pregnant. But I feel like she didn't look pregnant for a really long time.
Yeah, yeah.
And then like around the coronation, looked 9 months pregnant.
Yeah.
And then she still didn't have the baby for like another month. And I was like, how big is this baby going to get? I was like, God, it's going to be huge. It's going to be the biggest baby in the history of, it wasn't that big. But I was like, it's going to be the biggest baby. She was pregnant for so long, it felt like that last month. I was like, nope, she's about 12 months pregnant now. No one seems to be worried about this. It's just me. And I think it's really weird because obviously it's the first like baby in the kind of the Charles reign. Mm-hmm. But when August was born, she was the granddaughter of a monarch. But now she's the great, like the niece of a monarch, mm-hmm. and it's a bit different. So I feel like no one quite knew how to play like York babies anymore, because they're not in the central, the key line, but we've known about all their old children.
Yeah, no, that's something that I'd thought about as well. It's like, it should have been more significant than it was, because it's the first great-grandchild who was born, as you say, in the Charles era. So even though I don't think August, who's their older child, I don't think that he will like remember the Queen, maybe, you know, he might have fuzzy memories, but he's so little, he's only a toddler, I don't think he'll remember her as such. But I think they'll have pictures or they'll have anecdotes about, you know, we went to Balmoral and you kept crying and the only person who could get you to stop was the Queen. And that's a funny little anecdote that they can tell him when he grows up. This is the first time as a baby who will never have met the Queen. And I wonder, so I actually, in typical Jessica character, did not really follow what happened with the announcement that closely. I saw it on I saw it on social media. And obviously the announcement came about 5 days after the actual birth. And I checked back and they announced the birth of August, the oldest child, through a press release from Buckingham Palace on the day that the baby was born. Did Buckingham Palace do a press release or did they just like confirm it this time?
They just confirmed it to the media, I think, right, after Eugenie made her post. I think right, they just, I've not seen the press release and I've seen the press release for August birth. So I can only assume they just were like, statement, there you go.
Yeah, so I'm wondering if this actually is a shift now, like as you say, she's no longer the grandchild of the monarch, she is now the niece of the monarch, and that doesn't feel quite as close in a way. There's obviously the significance of it being just a milestone that this is the first baby born since the Queen died, not in the world but in the royal family, but also it is significant in that it kind of perhaps marks a shift in how we'll see announcements about things in the future. So if Beatrice has another child or if Eugenie has a third baby, that we can expect to see it this way.
I think definitely for any future like York babies, this is the template. But I'm really interested to see when Louise and James become older in like 10, 15 years and they have children of their own. Because if Charles is still alive, they're in the same position as Eugenie is, but Sophie and Edward are still working royals, whereas Andrew and Sarah are very much not working royals. But then also by the time James and Louise are old enough to have children, it very much could be William on the throne, and it's a whole different story again because then they're the cousin of the monarch. And it's a really weird position because chances are throughout Charles's reign there's going to be very few babies born, whereas obviously during the Queen's reign there was about 100 babies born. They had one every other week.
Because I think there was also like the Queen, although Andrew had been kicked out, the Queen still let him do a lot of things that Charles probably wouldn't have let him do. I know he went to like the coronation and things, but I think it's possible that it's partly because Eugenie is less closely connected. It could also be just because Charles wants to send a clear signal that, you know, there are certain people who are part of the family and certain people who are working royals, and there's a distinction between that. So we don't really know the reasoning, and it could also just be a fluke. Maybe Eugenie didn't tell them for 3 days and they were like, oh no, well we'll just leave it, and if anyone asks we'll say yeah, the baby's been born. And so the actual announcement itself, because it was on social media, came with some pictures, one of the baby and one of the baby with his older brother. And I think I've said this before, I'm not really a baby person. Like, it's different if you get to hold them because they're small and helpless, so you do feel an attachment to them. But when it's just a picture of a baby, like, sure, they're quite cute, but to me they all look exactly the same, all look small and scrunchy. I mean, there's not too much you can do with a photograph of a newborn. I do like that they include the siblings. I think that makes it a little bit more interesting, and is a nice kind of family moment, so I like that. But a picture just of a newborn baby on its own, it's not that exciting to me anyway.
Yeah, it was a nice picture. It was, I think August was born like just as we were coming out of the pandemic, so they were, and even though he was born in February, they took some outside photos and like, we want to thank our midwives and, you know, all the key workers, whereas they were just like, had a baby, here's August being a great brother, and which is very sweet, and August looked very like baby.
Yeah,
and I did quite like that. If you looked in the background, you could see like pink gift bags. So clearly, they had visitors.
Yeah, no, it's very sweet. I do like the sibling one, because yeah, it's a nice interactive thing. And I think a few other royal families have done that. You know, we had sibling photo of Charlotte and Louis, and we had Oscar and Estelle, and like, I think there is something very, even for to me in my cold dead heart, there is something very endearing about the kind of sibling thing of somebody who's obviously still little themselves looking after somebody who's even littler. I don't know, it's just cute. I'm still waiting for a royal to kind of do like a Photoshop of, you know, the baby with a dinosaur and the new, you know, their newborn like being held up like in The Lion King. I'm still waiting for that, but haven't had it yet.
One day, one of them will do it for us.
One day. And then his name.
The name. Yeah. The name surprised me in many a way.
Yeah.
So Eugenie announced the name in her Instagram post and then where the name came from. And then also the palace clarified because it was a slightly confused message.
Yeah, yeah.
So the baby is called Ernest George Ronnie Brooksbank. And he is named after, as Eugenie says, his great, great, great grandfather, George, his grandpa, George, and my grandpa, Ronald, which is very helpful because I always think all royals should tell me exactly where their names are from. Yeah. Otherwise, I have to guess and be like, maybe it's to do with his great aunt. I don't really know.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it's an interesting name. I will go into it in more detail in a second, but I think I know that there is nobody on earth who guessed the name Ernest George Ronnie. There, if anybody tells you they did, they are lying. So, but I think nobody, because I'd forgotten she was pregnant, I hadn't done like any predictions about what the name would be. And it's also, it's interesting, this maybe contributes to why I forgot she was pregnant, is that normally, even if I don't get asked on Tumblr, I see other people getting asked, like, what do you think Eugenie's going to call her baby? And I didn't see any of that this time around. It's like everybody collectively forgot she was pregnant.
Everyone's like, oh yeah, baby.
Yeah, poor Eugenie. But anyway, so because of that, I hadn't given it any thought at all. And then suddenly the name was here. So it was a bit late for that, for me to be like, oh yeah, well, I think the name is going to be when it was already announced. So I know that like the actual names, literally nobody would have guessed. But I do think that she kind of went a similar route to what she did with August. So like the path, I don't think anyone, if I had been doing predictions, I don't think anyone would have got it right, but I do think we could have got like a something in the ballpark.
Yeah, I might have guessed Ronald if I was if I'd actually gone for a guess. I might have put a Ronald in there because it was a George probably, because it was a very Eugenie and Jack baby name choice. But I wouldn't have guessed Ronnie, and yeah, Ernest was just not on my radar.
So Eugenie and Beatrice themselves, their mother, Sarah Ferguson, was a massive fan of Queen Victoria, like a massive fan. So the name sort of Beatrice came from Queen Victoria's daughter, Princess Beatrice. And the name Eugenie was also a name that kind of floated around, or Eugenia kind of floated around in various royals from the past, kind of like side royals, who were connected in some way or another. So she kind of chose names that were royal. They were royal names, but they hadn't been used in a while. And then when Eugenie had her son August or Augustus more normally, was a very sort of common, or was a common name in the royals kind of pre-First World War, when they were still okay to be German. After the First World War, they started to kind of ditch a lot of the German sounding names because they thought it was inappropriate. But August or Augustus was common in lots of the royal families, especially like the Hanover branch. So they have an Ernst August. They basically just recreated the Prince of Hanover with their two children.
That's why I kept thinking he was called Ernst. For ages, I was like, Ernst. And I was like, oh, Ernest? Oh, that's somehow weird.
The Prince of Hanover, who is married to Princess Caroline and is sort of a distant relative of the British royals, and would have been a claimant to the British throne and all that sort of stuff. He is called Ernst August. His son is called Ernst August. And they're names that kind of are part of the family. So that's with August, his first name was a shortened version of a very common pre-war British royal family name. His second name was Philip. And then the last name was Hawke, which is an unusual name and is an old family name in Jack's family. So it was kind of like a pre-war royal name that hadn't been used for a while. Then a maternal grandfather, and then a paternal name connected to Jack's family. So actually they did a very similar thing that happens with both Eugenie's name and August's name with Ernest. Like Ernest is a name that would have been, that was relatively common amongst that kind of pre-war generation when they were all okay with being German. And I think she said it was, I think it's George V, whose middle name is Ernest, who's this baby.
I did a lot of Googling, and Eugenie said great-great-great-grandfather, who is George V. And then I saw some of the royal reporters double-checked with the palace, who said George V. And then Sarah Ferguson went on her podcast and said George III, which just confuses everyone.
Yeah,
I think it's George V, because I'm going to trust what Eugenie says about what she named her own child.
About her own child, yeah. And George the Third didn't even have the name Ernest, so it definitely wasn't him.
Yeah.
So I think it was an honor of a family member who she never would have met. So it's basically very similar to August and to Eugenie in that it's a name that is royal but hasn't been used in a while, so maybe doesn't feel it's not a George. So I think that, and then the second one was George, which is a paternal grandfather, and obviously with August it was Philip, which is the maternal grandfather, and then the last name was a slightly unusual tribute to the other side of the family that hadn't yet been mentioned. So in August it was Hawk, which was a Brooksbank family name, and with Ernest they just basically flipped them around, and so it was Ronnie, and it was a shortened version of Ronald Ferguson, who was Sarah Ferguson's father. So I never would have got the actual name, but if somebody had asked me, anybody, it's actually perfectly aligned with what she did with the first child. So if they do have another one, I think we know the formula.
Yeah, we could predict the third baby, I'm going to get their name dead on.
Yeah. But don't like it.
No, I can't get over the fact that Oggy and Ernie, which I know sound very cute together, but they also, Oggy sounds like a dog and Ernie sounds like someone from EastEnders. Yeah. And I can't unsee that, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I had somebody say something to me. I don't know if they were trying to be funny or if they genuinely didn't know, but they said to me, oh, I wish they'd called August Albert so that we could have had a Bertie and an Ernie. And I was like, Bert and Ernie, like Sesame Street. that would be a terrible, that would actually be brilliant, but terrible. No, I think my problem is I just don't like the name Ernest. And I think it's one of those sort of virtue names. You've got a virtue name. Your name is Grace.
I do.
So there's grace and charity and chastity and hope and faith and all of those, and they're fine. But the difference, I was thinking about this last night when I couldn't sleep. I think the difference is, like, your name is not graceful. Your name is Grace. It's a noun. It's a thing. I mean, you have grace. Ernest is an adjective.
Yeah.
And so it is very much a descriptive name. So it's, I don't know, it's like, calling your child Speedy because they're fast, or clever George Ronnie. That's what it, Ernest to me will, as a first name, will always sound as if it's a description of a person. So it sounds to me like they're saying that his name is his baby whose name is George Ronnie, and he is an Ernest baby.
No, I think I know we view, like, Frank as a normal name now. Like, we don't go, like, yeah. Frank, oh, you're so Frank. But I did know someone who had twins called Frank and Ernest.
Oh, gosh.
Like, no, you can't call them that.
You can't.
They don't go together, because then you're thinking, oh, he's very Frank and he's very Ernest. And what if they're not? Like, that's a real worry for me now.
Yeah. And I know it's not spelled the same, and maybe it doesn't have the same root. I don't even know. But when you're speaking, that's all I think about. And because of the name Ronnie, which is very, like, EastEnders, as you said, very Only Fools and Horses, kind of wheeler dealer in a pub, a Cockney guy in a pub in Peckham or Croydon, not Peckham anymore, that's really nice now, like Croydon, somewhere like that. And his name is George Ronnie. He's the guy in the pub who tries to sell you an old TV out of the back of a van. His name is George Ronnie. And ironically, because he's a cheat, everybody calls him Ernest. So he's Ernest George Ronnie. And that's what it makes me think. He's like a Cockney gangster.
Yeah, it is. Because it's weird, because, like, they are all really, like, old traditional names. And they're all old man names. Old man names are in fashion, but they are all old man names. But also, like, I always think, like, August Philip Hawk was a name where she could either have then gone really old or really modern, because you can play that either way. It's like, I have a cousin called Ava, and when her parents were pregnant again, I was like, they're either going to go really old fashioned, something like Oliver or, you know, James, or they're going to go really modern, and they went Jamie. So I was like, oh, they've gone modern. And I think with August, I didn't quite know whether she was going to go for the old man, ancient Ernie George route, or whether she would have gone something slightly more like a modern version of it, like Eddie or something. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
But yes, they definitely went for the very old man version. And it's kind of, not that it's made August's name sound really old, but it has made August's name sound old, because I put them together as old people names now. Whereas before I was like, yeah, August. I'm like, oh, the old men in the family.
Yeah. I think it would have, if it had just been Ronald, it might have been different, but it's just that Ronnie. Did he go by Ronnie? I'd never heard him being referred to as Ronnie Ferguson ever.
Sounds like Ronald.
Sounds like a football manager, doesn't it, Ronnie Ferguson?
Yeah, Ronnie Ferguson is manager of I don't know, what, Rangers?
Yeah.
Like a Scottish football team.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, ultimately, it doesn't matter, because she's picked the name, and it's got nothing to do with me. But I'm going to say it's not my favourite. I like the idea of picking a name. Like, I really like Beatrice and Eugenie as names. And I like, so in a more distant branch of the family, somebody else did a similar thing and called their daughter Maud, which is a name that hasn't been used in the royal family for a while, but is very much part of the family. And so I do like that, of kind of doing something that's slightly different from a Charles and a Henry and that kind of thing. But I just don't like this. I just don't like the name Ernest, really.
Yeah, it's the Ernest that throws me off, I think. I could deal with George Ronnie. I can't deal with Ernest George Ronnie.
There's, if you look back at the names of that era, the ones where they're, before they stripped all of the German princes, so they were all German, but they all were still British princes. There were some really interesting ones. There's one that's called like Octavius or something. Like, give me an Octavius.
Yeah, they could have been August and Octavius. I would have been that.
Yeah. So... stuff like that. Let's bring that back. Okay, so our second big topic of the week, we're aware of the fact that the big talking point really about royals at the moment has been this ongoing court case that Prince Harry has around phone hacking and things like that with the press. We wanted to kind of talk about something that was relevant, but also not talk about that specifically. Because I think, firstly, he's a private citizen now, so we kind of have drawn lines around what we do and don't talk about. But also the case is still ongoing. And so there's always the risk that we say something and then it's out of date before the episode even goes live, which has happened before, and it's very frustrating. So I think we thought we would use it not to talk about specifically Harry's case, but to talk about kind of the known facts about phone hacking in the royal family and kind of the origin story for Harry's current court case.
Love an origin story.
Love an origin story. Before, to kind of understand the phone hacking scandal, you kind of have to look back at the history of the royals and the press. And obviously we could talk about that for hours. So I'm going to try and keep it quite top level. For decades and decades with the royal family and the press, there was a kind of deference to the royal family. There was a kind of idea that it wasn't necessarily that you didn't criticize them or that, you know, if they did something wrong, you didn't say, but there was sort of just like a line that was, you know, that wasn't crossed. So I know I've read stories about like the press or photographers getting photographs of the Queen with her skirt blowing up in the wind, and they chose to destroy the film rather than publish it because they thought it was inappropriate to publish something like that of the Queen when she was younger. Or there's that very famous scene in The Crown that depicts a fight. I think this really happened. It depicts a fight between the Queen and Philip that kind of spilled out into the garden when they were in Africa, and some press people were there, but they all sort of voluntarily agreed to destroy any record of it and to not talk about it, really. So there was that kind of, I think there was definitely a kind of respect that the press gave to the royal family. And that's not to say that there wasn't kind of tabloid journalism at the time, because there was, but the newspapers were also largely owned by a small number of fairly aristocratic families. And so I think that there was kind of a deep respect for the monarchy. There was this idea that, you know, you don't want to publish anything that is going to tarnish the image of the monarchy. And so for quite a long time, I think that was really the relationship that existed.
Even like sort of looking back through history, I think initially it really kind of stemmed from that whole treason. Like you didn't want to just writing a newspaper article saying, you know, King Charles II has wasted all the money on this in case King Charles II got you beheaded. And then I think, you know, obviously as we moved away from beheading people from speaking ill of the monarchy to, you know, the more modern era, there was still, you know, not obviously a fear, but a kind of like born from a fear, a respect of like, well, you just don't print bad stuff about the monarchy because they're the monarchy. And it was a kind of deference and respect that didn't extend to politicians who have always very much been free game.
Yeah, so I think that was kind of the state of play for quite a while. The sort of 1960s and 1970s was when things started to change because of a little guy who, I don't know if people have heard of him, his name is Rupert Murdoch.
and Rupert, isn't he still influencing things now?
Yeah, I wonder where he went, that Rupert Murdoch guy. I haven't heard much from him. So he moved into UK journalism. I did get sucked into some articles about Rupert Murdoch when I was looking at this. And although he's a terrible person, he was very young. He was a bit of a rebel. He was Australian, so he was an outsider. He wasn't aristocratic. And he very much came in the late 60s, early 70s, bought up a couple of UK newspapers, News of the World and things, and kind of destroyed this monopoly that aristocratic families had over the press. And so he really was a big shake-up of the journalism industry in the UK. And I think his focus was on kind of selling newspapers at any cost. And so there was, throughout the sort of next few decades, there was a real low point in, I mean, there's been a few low points in journalism history in the UK, but I'd say that's one of them, like things like the way that the HIV/AIDS crisis was handled and the incredibly homophobic front covers that were on some of his newspapers, or, you know, the outright lies that were made up about celebrities. And so he introduced things like that, where it was like, I'm going to make, I don't care about the quality, I don't care about the accuracy, I don't care about any of that. What I care about is shifting newspapers, and we will do that at any cost. And so I think once it sort of reached like the late 1970s, 1980s, in the royal family, you had the breakdown of Sarah and Andrew's marriage, the breakdown of Princess Anne's marriage, the War of the Waleses that happened in the sort of 80s and 90s. And I think you had a dual thing of an unusually high number of scandals and controversies happening with the royal family, and a press where, through Murdoch's influence, everyone else was trying to keep up with him. There was kind of a feeling that, like, they are no longer off limits. You know, there's this guy who's in charge of it, who's like some random Australian guy. He doesn't care about these people. All he cares about is selling newspapers. So whereas a few decades earlier, the press might have gone, well, we won't talk about this. We know that they're, you know, going to divorce, but we're not going to talk about it for as long as possible because we want, out of respect, you know, we're not going to do that. Now, by sort of the time we reach the kind of 80s and 90s, that was no longer the case. Basically, the press were kind of like, well, this is something that people are going to want to read about, so we're going to publish it. And so I think that really marked a shift in the way that the royals and the press interacted.
You know, it's hard to overstate how politically influential Rupert Murdoch is.
Oh, for sure.
And I think there was a bit, I remember I was in secondary school and they were like, you know, this man, Rupert Murdoch, he owns all these newspapers. And they were like, every single person that he has publicly backed has become prime minister.
Yeah.
And I think it still carries on. And I think, you know, you had someone who, like you said, was an outsider and came into the UK and then within 20 years was probably the most powerful person in the UK in terms of, you know, the reach he had. And he was, you know, had sort of overwhelming lead voice. He could just sort of choose what was going in and out of what sort of direction he wanted his newspapers to take. And at the same time, we also had more access from foreign press. And I think the difference that had existed was very much only between the British press and the British monarchy. So as soon as you throw in an Australian and then a whole bunch of other foreign media, they never had that deference. And there was always a situation of, well, if it's being published in France, we might as well publish it as well.
Yes, definitely. I think, the landscape changed. So it was a few different things that kind of contributed to it. I think partially the royal family scandals all happening kind of in close succession meant that it was hard to ignore them. But also, you know, and of course, as I mentioned, the influence of Rupert Murdoch and the way that he kind of shifted the tabloid landscape and made salaciousness, and that he made that the currency of the newspapers. Instead, you know, they'd always have gossip and things like that, but that it'd always been kind of like, these papers are for the gossip, and it's kind of harmless gossip, it doesn't really matter. He made it so that was the only thing that mattered. It wasn't sort of, we'll have a bit of gossip, we'll have a bit of quality. It was, all that matters is the gossip. And if we get sued, we'll deal with that afterwards. So that was part of it. But also, as you say, it was just a changing landscape. technology had advanced and people were communicating in different ways, and there was a more globalized world. So now that we had people who were looking to the royals all the time for what was going on and kind of photographs that could be beamed around the world within a few hours or whatever. So it was a few different factors that kind of contributed towards this shift. And I also think the royals engaged. So beforehand, it might have been the case that maybe they did go to the palace with a scandal and said, oh, what do you think? And they just kind of said, well, no, we're not engaging with it. Whereas very particularly Charles and Diana both decided that for a very long time that they were going to play that game. And so the press were kind of reveling in being able to talk about all of the scandals that were going on in the royal family and always looking for the next big one. But the royals chose to engage with them, and then only realized a bit too late, like, we can't close this door that we've opened. So it was a few different factors that led to the shift. But I think that's when we started to see the first examples of kind of early violations of privacy. So the tampon gate and squidgy gate is the other one, which doesn't get mentioned as much, but these were kind of phone calls that were tapped during this kind of sort of late 80s, early 90s period. So the tampon gate is a call that was tapped between Camilla and Charles, which it's called tampon gate. And this annoys me. I don't know if it's just me. It's called that because in the conversation, I can't believe I'm talking about this, but in the conversation, Charles says that he, to Camilla, that he wishes he could live inside her trousers. And he makes a joke saying, oh, but knowing my luck, I'd probably end up coming back as a tampon. And it's a joke. And he's saying that's not a desirable thing. He doesn't want to be a tampon, but he's making a joke about it. And yet when you hear people talk about it, they're like, oh, Charles once said that he desperately wants to be Camilla's tampon and he's really into that. And that's what gets him off. That's not what happened. It's the exact opposite. And it really irritates me that everybody gets that so wrong and just doesn't care. But yeah, that was sort of taped conversations that happened and the transcripts ended up coming out. But there was also the phone calls that were intercepted that Diana had with James Gilby, who was a friend of hers, who they kind of had some slightly potentially inappropriate calls. There was no sort of exciting tampon bit, but he called her squidgy a lot, which is incredibly blech. But anyway, so you're seeing basically the first major violations of privacy, and I think what we talk about later on in this episode is most people agree is like a violation of privacy, and it's always talked about in that context. But the two situations that happened in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, particularly the tampon gate one, I only ever hear people bring that up as like, oh my gosh, this is a salacious bit of gossip, or isn't this a weird thing that Charles once said? You don't hear about it as being a violation of privacy, but their calls were tapped. Like, it's terrible.
And it's like, I don't want to like equate it to sexual harassment or anything, but it was like a private, you know, sexual discussion between them. And, you know, if someone, you know, quite rightly gets their nudes leaked on the internet, everyone's like, well, that's awful. That's a violation of privacy. But it's, you know, it's the verbal version of having your nudes leaked in a national newspaper.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, yeah, that's fun. Let's talk about that. It's like, no.
Even in Harry's court case, he refers to it as being kind of like an embarrassing moment, and the royals didn't want that more, you know, more embarrassment. It was like, but it was also a massive violation of everybody's privacy. Why is nobody mentioning this?
Yeah, and I also think, like, obviously they would like the two most, probably like some of the most high profile people in the world.
Yeah.
And it was very, like, there was no way they weren't hiding the fact that they tapped their phones. Like, when we talk about the later on things, they were very much hiding any sort of phone tapping. They were like, what? No, we didn't do that. Whereas at this point, they were like, yeah, put it on the front page of the newspaper.
Yeah.
That we have just listened to their private conversations. And I know there was, you know, like at the time, people were like a bit of, especially politically, like, you can't tap the phones of a member of the royal family.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, even for Diana, who there was never that kind of like, how dare you tap her phone? It was more like, ooh, squidgy.
I mean, I don't understand why now we haven't had a moment where we revisit that and think about that again. I can understand why at the time it was considered to be fine, because I think that it just become normalized that, like, the scandals, the, you know, the, Diana and Charles were going on the TV every 5 minutes, or were planning photo opportunities, or were collaborating with authors who were writing books about them. And everybody knew that. And so it was kind of normalized that if they're not violating their own privacy, does it really matter, you know, does it really matter if somebody else violates their privacy because they're doing it themselves? So I think that was, I don't remember really, because I was either not born or very small, but I can imagine, I can understand why at the time it wasn't viewed as a massive violation of privacy, because it had just become normalized that like the royals were now open for business and the deference was completely gone.
Yeah, it's, I think, you know, I'm more surprised that Diana's phone call hasn't become more of a thing. But I think particularly in the kind of the last couple of years, and the narrative and the kind of like the Crown and the Diana film and all of this about how, you know, she was treated badly by the royal family and by the press, they're like, it's a perfect, you know, no one's ever gone, and remember that time her phone, you know, people were listening in on her phone calls and recording that in the newspaper that everyone was reading. Like, it's not like we don't talk about sort of phone tapping and we don't talk about the way Diana was treated, and they just never get kind of brought together. And I think it's because if you brought that up, you'd also have to go, oh, and also Charles got tapped at the same time.
Yes.
But people don't really want to focus on that.
And also Diana was talking to people pre-1990 that in a way that may have been inappropriate. I mean, it wasn't quite as sexualized from what I remember as Charles's calls, but it, you know, it, you might have to then acknowledge that this was a complicated situation where everybody did things wrong and nobody was fantastic and nobody really seems to want to do that. So this had just kind of become the normal situation that, you know, these sorts of things were happening. And then Diana died. The laugh wasn't about Diana's death. It was just about like the, oh, well, that changed things, sort of, you know.
Then it all changed again.
I think the... Again, I was only very little, so I don't really remember like the press specifically, but I think that there was, even if there wasn't like an apology or a moment of contrition, or even if you don't believe that the press was really as involved as people think, I think there was a sense that they were an easy target to blame for everything. And it was easy to say that, you know, they'd made Diana's life hell in the last few years and all these sorts of things. And so there was definitely a kind of pause for a moment of reflection. And I think particularly when it came to the way that they were going to talk about William and Harry from that moment onwards.
Yeah, and I think you're right that you know, they did change kind of the way they did things, but the deference never really went to any other royals other than William and Harry. And I think it was very much almost like, not guilt, but kind of like when you can't say sorry to someone and you then have to say sorry to like the next best person.
Yeah.
And the next best person to Diana were her two children. So everyone just kind of went, right, we'll be nice to them.
Yeah.
For now. But we will be nice.
Yeah. And I think it was also, you know, Charles had some really good press people around him at the time as well. The primary way that this kind of manifested, I think, is the gentlemen's agreements. A gentleman's agreement, if people don't know, is basically an agreement that isn't like a contract or a legal document. You might not even have it written down anywhere, but it's just a kind of understanding that you reach that you will both do something and, you know, you have an understanding, I suppose. So it's an agreement without it really being written down. And the agreement that was come to with the press and the palace at the time was kind of like, give us a little bit of William and Harry because we care about them and people want to read about them. And then in exchange, we'll leave you alone. So like at the beginning of a holiday, you do a press call, a photo call, and maybe a little interview, and then we'll leave you alone for the rest of the holiday. Or the first day of school, you do a photo shoot, and then we'll leave you alone for the rest of school and we won't go near you. And so that was kind of the way that they tentatively tried to kind of find a balance where the boys weren't hidden away, but the press weren't going to be overstepping that mark as they had done with Diana and Charles and Camilla and, you know, various other people throughout the late 80s and early 90s.
There's a lot about the gentleman's agreement that very much heavily influences today. And I think it was that kind of, even in other royal families, it was that kind of, if we give you a bit, then we'll step back. And even though, you know, it doesn't necessarily still work to the same extent, and it doesn't work with every publication, there's definitely an element of, well, if you give us, you know, what we expect, then we're not going to dig in. But if you don't, we are going to dig in because you've not honoured your side of it. And I think, you know, a lot of the kind of really big stories of the last few years have come from predominantly the royals not honouring their side of the gentleman's agreement and not giving that kind of information that the public and the press sort of expect from royals.
And for a while, it did work very well in the UK as well. I think people forget that. Like, if you think about the Eton days and things, especially with William, he was very well protected, you know, that people did allow him the space to get on with his own business. And, you know, they would go on holidays, take their photographs, and then the press would leave them alone and they wouldn't photograph them again for the rest of the ski trip, which is something that had happened with Diana, where the press were like in the chalet trying to get photographs and those sorts of things. It didn't last long, but it did for a few years. It did work.
Yeah, it's like it did work. It was kind of proof that it could work.
It could.
And it gets to work again, if I think, you know. But then I think, obviously, as time's gone on and has continued to go on, you know, it's always that kind of like, once you've had a bit, people want more. And suddenly, you know, a photo call at the start of a ski trip isn't enough. You want to get, like, the best picture. You want a picture of, you know, Charles falling over or, you know, someone kissing someone or just something.
Yeah,
and then they loiter and it's kind of snowballs, which was not an intentional pun but worked.
Yes, skiing snowball. I think there's kind of two reasons in my view why things shifted. So firstly, part of the agreement, well, I think it was easier to uphold the agreement when they were at places like Eton or St Andrews, where it's, I mean, St Andrews is fairly isolated. It is hard to get the press up there. Not impossible, but more difficult than it would be if you'd gone to a university in like London or Manchester or somewhere like that, because it's a tiny little town. And Eton is closed door, you know, and it's a school, so you can't have people just wandering around the grounds unannounced. You know, that doesn't happen. So it was easier for the press to honour their agreement because they probably wouldn't have been able to get access anyway. But then once William in particular sort of left and went to university and started getting dates and seeing women and going out on the town, going out drinking, I think the press were like, this is too juicy to ignore. That was their attitude. I'm not saying it's right, but I think that was their attitude. They're like, we want to, they're starting to have girlfriends. This is something the press, the people are going to want to read so about so much. It's going to sell so many papers. We have to be the first one who gets the photograph of him with his new girlfriend. So that was one element, is that I think that it, much like with the sort of 80s situation in the 90s, it was just the quality of the stories. They knew that they were going to get so much readership from it that they felt like it was worth violating the agreement. But then I also think you've got my hero, the Machiavellian genius, the man whose fan club I'm the president of, Mark Boland, who was Prince Charles's, then Prince Charles's deputy private secretary, who, I say this with confidence, he is the reason that Camilla is queen today. Just, it's him. He rehabilitated her. It is him. But he, I think, also opened the door slightly in that previously they might have gone to the royals and said, we've heard this story. I don't think he planted a lot of stuff, but I think they might have gone to him and said, we heard this story that, you know, Harry's doing this or William's doing this. And before, they might have gone, no comment. And Mark Boland was like, I'm going to take that story and I'm going to say, oh, yes, it did happen. And Charles is very concerned and is a great father. And Camilla's really helping him out. And isn't that lovely? And so it was a combination, I think, of the reason that that agreement didn't really work out was a combination of the stories were becoming too good to ignore. They felt like, well, William's in his 20s now. He's dating. She could be a future queen. We have a justification to write about this. And the royals were starting to once again engage with the machinery of the press. And so they were kind of like, it's very hard once you've opened that door to close it off again.
And I also think back in the kind of like the days of deference, like early Queen Elizabeth's reign, they still did news stories on, like, you know, Princess Elizabeth has had her heart, you know, stolen by a dashing young naval soldier. Like, they still had those stories. They might not have followed them into, I don't think they went to nightclubs, but, you know, they might not have followed them into palaces and taken photos of them sort of kissing in the garden. But the press always did, you know, page 16, a little story that Princess Anne has a secret love at the palace. And we don't know who it is, but we know she's very, very happy about it. And I think, you know, they were okay because, you know, the press weren't going anywhere near them. And they were also doing it in a fairly sort of lighthearted, positive manner. Whereas, you know, in the 2000s, it was, look at, you know, Harry or William falling out of a nightclub. What a loser. Which, you know, is a far more negative way to spin things. But I think, you know, they took almost like the initial idea was like, well, we have this gentleman's agreement. This is how we used to do things really well. Let's just do that. But for a modern era. And then obviously for a modern era, it is gossip and salacious stuff that people want to hear about. And I think particularly in the 2000s, which was peak tabloid era, you know, it was the era of Paris Hilton and, you know, the big, I don't even know how, what, they're not influencers, but that's the only way I can think to describe them.
Socialites, like a lot of socialites and it girls.
That kind of key era. It was a perfect time for there to be salacious gossip of rich aristocratic people. So it I'm not saying it was the right thing to do, but it did feel very natural. It didn't feel like they were being targeted really above and beyond the other people of their generation and their sort of standing.
You know, there was a new advent of things like social media that people engaged with but didn't necessarily understand fully. So, like, I mean, there are a lot of people who are like minor members of the Belgian royal family and stuff. And if you go to their Facebook accounts, they obviously haven't realized that they haven't scrubbed all the information from like 2006. And so it's still up there. They might have great security controls now, but they didn't in 2006 and they haven't gone back and checked. So, you know, if you're early 2000s, people were starting to get mobile phones and starting to get on social media, but they didn't necessarily understand how these things worked. So it was very easy for people to tap in. And it was also very easy now to kind of like find the name of a person who was seen with a royal and to then find all of their family and where they went to university and to find their address and all those sorts of things that might have been more difficult before when they didn't have the internet was a lot easier to do. So it was kind of like, it probably didn't feel to the press like they were doing at this point anyway, it probably didn't feel like they were doing anything that bad because it was all very easy to do.
And it is, you know, at its core, investigative journalism. It's just, you know, that is what the press do. Like a good journalist finds, you know, sees something and it's like, well, I'm going to go and find out all the facts. And that's what they did. And I think particularly with that initial kind of only, you know, using social media, it's not illegal. You know, it might be immoral, but I mean, I know I've done it. I've seen someone or, you know, read someone's address and gone, I'm going to stalk them. You know, I want to find out exactly who this person, where do they live? You know, what do they do?
We've set the backdrop very nicely, I think, Grace.
Yeah, we've built up a scene.
Built up a scene, painted a picture. But the phone hacking scandal itself actually started in 2005. So we know that the government was aware of phone hacking as early as the late 1990s, but they'd largely kept it hidden from the public. And so the general public didn't really know anything about phone hacking. Obviously, there had been this kind of like tapping with Charles and Diana and that era, but that was largely forgotten or had been made into sort of something salacious rather than a violation of privacy. And then in 2005, an article featured in the News of the World, which was a Murdoch paper, which said that Prince William was borrowing a portable editing suite from Tom Bradbury, who worked for ITV and did the engagement interview for William and Kate, and he was their friend for a while. And William saw this or heard about it, and he knew that only him, Tom, and two other people were aware of this story. And he'd been growing suspicious for a while because of other stories about like an injury that only a small number of people knew about. And he thought it was a bit strange. And so basically he met with Tom to find out what happened. And they quickly began to think that it could be that their phones were being hacked because they hadn't told anybody else who could have gone to the press with this. And so they went to the police and the police started the investigation and got the ball rolling around phone hacking.
When William and Tom Brady went to the priest, they didn't go to any priest, they went to the police. But when they went to the police went through, you know, setting up investigations because obviously it was a member of the royal family who'd come in and said, I'm fairly sure my, you know, someone's been at my phone. But because it was royal, they went straight to counterterrorism and it was set up as a counterterrorism unit because obviously at that point, they didn't know if someone was hacking William's phone, but if they did, who it was. And, you know, it could be, you know, it might have just been a bit of gossip coming from a friend, or it could have been, you know, a terror organ, a terror cell. And, you know, I think at that point, and this wasn't, you know, public knowledge. So very sort of, you know, completely behind the scenes, there was a massive, well, not massive, but at that point, a fairly small counterterrorism investigation into what was going on with the phone of Prince William and his aides, like his It was not next of kin, because that's family, but next of kin servants.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that the group that the royal press officers, royal protection officers at the time, so the people who looked after the royals, I think that they were like part of a unit that was also part of the anti-terrorism stuff. So it kind of just naturally fell to them. But they were quite busy because there was the terrorist attack in London in 2005. So they were fairly busy with stuff that was going on, you know, had a lot going on. But obviously, you know, as you say, Prince William could have anybody's number on there and could have been talking to anybody. So what they found through the investigation was that although Prince William's phone had been hacked, it was mostly the people around him who had been hacked. So I think that the story from Todd Bradbury actually came from Jamie Lowther Pinkerton, who is a very close family friend and was the private secretary for William for a while. And I think that was how they mostly did it, as far as I'm aware, was like they made calls to phones and they hacked the voicemail of somebody on the outside, and then they could hear what William had said to them in voicemails. The point of it is that basically it was the royal phone hacking, or the phone hacking scandal as it became, was kind of started because of Prince William. He kicked it off, really.
Yeah, which is, I mean, like, deep down, I knew the timeline was like the William hacking happened and that was investigated, and then the other phone hacking scandal happened. But I never quite made the connection in my head that if it, you know, essentially if William and Tom hadn't gone to the police and gone, look, we know someone has gone in our phones somehow, you know, someone's hacked our phones, we don't know what's happened. Like, you know, like you said, the police and the politicians, they were all aware of phone hacking in the 90s, mm-hmm. but they didn't do anything. Really,
yeah,
no. Especially to the wider world, to gone past William's thing. And I think if William and Tom hadn't gone to the police, it mm-hmm. possibly could have carried on,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
could still be carrying on today, very much like everyone knows but we don't talk about it situation. Yeah.
Two people were arrested, a PI called Mulcair, I think Glenn Mulcair, and a royal reporter called Clive Goodman. And they were placed on trial in 2006 and pleaded guilty to hacking the phones of royals and the people around them over 600 times. I got sucked into reading about Rupert Murdoch, I got sucked into reading about the phone hacking scandal, which is very confusing, and also a lot of it is not relevant. But I do know that the police didn't want to move anything forward. So they had bags and bags of evidence of all of these people that had been hacked. And they basically told a couple of like government figures and really, really high profile people that their phone had been hacked, but then didn't tell anybody else. And the press said, oh, it was just Clive Goodman and a few rotten apples, even though Mulcair, the co-defendant, had kind of admitted to hacking other people who were not royals, and who, so it had obviously been ordered by somebody else, not Clive Goodman. Other people started to piece things together, and they started bringing their own cases to the courts, as civil cases, and to police. So it took a while. It wasn't sort of like William reported it and then all of a sudden everybody knew they'd been hacked. Other newspapers, especially those in the Murdoch group, so like The Sun, but also The Mirror, were kind of implicated. And the idea was that these private investigators like Mulcair had been working for multiple different newspapers. So yeah, it was kind of a bit messy. But I think what I think is really interesting is, and I vaguely remember this time because I was sort of 13 when the phone hacking scandal with William came out. No one cared. I can tell you when people cared about the phone hacking scandal. It wasn't until 6 years later, in 2011, it was found out that one of the people whose phones had been hacked was Millie Dowler, who was a murdered teenager. And the press had been hacking her phone and listening to her voicemails, which is disgusting anyway. But also because of that, it meant that voicemails that were new were showing up as having been listened to. And so for quite a while, actually, the police and her family thought she might still be alive because her voicemails were being listened to. And so that was what caused the outrage and led to the Leveson inquiry, which was a big inquiry that was done into phone hacking sort of late in 2011. It wasn't actually the royals at all, because really, nobody cared all that much. A point I wanted to just mention is that, like, when Clive Goodman spoke in 2014, so this was quite a long time after all this, he said that he'd hacked Kate's phone 155 times, William's 35, and Harry's 9. Now, obviously, he was just one person who was involved. There was probably phone hacking at other places and maybe with other journalists and things. But I think the royals themselves were targeted. And lots of other celebrities were targeted. But whether it's right or wrong, most people didn't feel sorry for celebrities who could go home and console themselves in a mansion. And I'm not saying that that's the right thing or that, you know, we shouldn't have empathy for these people. I'm just saying that was the fact that, like, most people didn't really care about what was happening to extremely rich people. But it was when they targeted people like Millie Dowler that that's when people couldn't hold back their disgust anymore. And that's when it became a real scandal. And so something I think is often overlooked in this is that, like, Kate was disproportionately targeted when she was a private citizen compared to William and Harry. And it was, you know, Jamie Latha Pinkerton was the person whose phone was hacked that got the story for William about that kicked this all off. So there was really a focus on targeting the people around them. And I think that often gets overlooked. Like, everybody's talking about William's phone was hacked and Harry's phone was hacked. But, like, the phones that were mostly hacked were the servants and staff and friends and people who don't have that privilege as in the same way or didn't at the time.
Yeah, I think, you know, I have no memory of the William hacking when it happened because I was 9. But I do remember Millie Dowler because I remember I was at a week-long sort of summer camp thing at the University of the West of England instead of work experience, sent some of us there. And we were giving, like, presentations, and it was, like, the topic. And we were a bunch of teenagers about the same age as Millie Dowler, you know, when she died, and being like, oh, have you heard? Like, that's so horrible. And, you know, it wasn't the first time there'd been a really big news story that I remember learning about, but it's the first time a really big news story happened that was, like, political.
Yeah.
That I remember talking about.
Yeah.
You know, like, I remember talking about when Michael Jackson died, and I remember learning about, you know, Madeleine McCann going missing, but I didn't talk about that, whereas this one was everywhere. And, you know, and then, you know, obviously it came out, it was Millie Dowler, and it was, you know, the families of people who died in Afghanistan, and it was the victims of the terror bombings, and, you know, and like you said, like the normal people. So, you know, there had been, you know, Sienna Miller was hacked, and she did quite an early civil case that everyone was like, oh, there's more people. But then it was the people, the normal people, the everyday people that really sort of touched, you know, that's the reason people cared. And I think, you know, like you said, when, you know, Clive Goodman finally admitted to, you know, hacking royals, which, you know, was, what was it, like, 8 years after being arrested, yeah. I never hacked a royal, only the aides, which, as if that makes it better. And he was like, yeah, I did hack William and Harry's phone, but I also hacked all their aides' phones, and I hacked, you know, Charles's aides' phones. And, you know, if you look at Kate or Chelsea, who were hacked disproportionately more than William or Harry, like, he said he first hacked Kate's phone in December 2005, and he last hacked her phone on the 7th of August, the day before he was arrested in 2006. So that's in less than a year, he hacked her phone 155 times. So someone like Millie Dowler, who, you know, was a missing child, or the families of these sort of soldiers or families of victims from the bombings, their phones could have been hacked any number of times, I think, within across the years, because it was a longer period of time from, you know, Goodman starting and being arrested, because he was the royal editor. So as soon as you take him out, there's all these people who were doing it for a lot longer.
But yeah, it's interesting because they kind of, it was a massive, massive thing in sort of 2011. And then the News of the World closed and the Leveson Inquiry ended up recommending the establishment of a regulator, which was called IPSO, which still exists. And so cases continued to be brought and have been ever since. For the last sort of 12 years, we've had regular cases. I think one of the newspapers set aside like £52 million for claims that were brought to do with phone hacking. But it was kind of, as a member of the public, it was kind of like over. The press and the police and various other places were kind of pitching it as it was the News of the World that was the problem. And once the News of the World is closed down, that's the problem over. And so it wasn't really until Harry brought his current case and started talking more about other newspapers and things that it's kind of come back up into the public and people are really talking about it a lot. Even though there were all these cases, I think a lot of people were like, well, this was something that happened at the News of the World and it was terrible, but it's closed down now and we can all move on with our lives.
I always thought it was really weird because I'm going to be honest, the first time I heard of the News of the World was when it closed down.
Yeah.
But like, I always thought it was really bizarre that at the time that closed down and everyone was like, okay, because right from the start, it was the Murdoch group of newspapers. Yes. It was the News of the World and the Sun and the Mirror.
Yeah.
And I know, you know, there was a lot of high level personnel changes, like a lot of people, you know, resigned or were fired in that kind of immediate follow up. Yeah. But I think, and you know, the News of the World was of the more surprisingly the biggest paper.
Mm-hmm.
It had the biggest sort of weekly following and the biggest weekly readership, and that was where the sort of the key members of what, you know, in mm-hmm. the phone hacking were working. Everyone kind of went, as soon as the News of the World closed, were like, well, that's all sorted then. And I was mm-hmm. like, no, the other newspapers are still there. Yeah. And the people who did the phone hacking still work for them.
Yeah. Or in some cases are appointed to work for the Prime Minister briefly.
Just go to the top dog. And it's like, I'm sure, you know, it was harder to hack phones in the immediate aftermath when the police were looking into phone hacking. But I also think that, you know, once the story dies down again, if you know you've got, it might be an illegal, but it is a foolproof way of getting a good story that actually the police don't seem that into sort of investigating. You know, if there is a massive story, you might be like, look, I know we said we're not going to do it, but we've still got that PI on our books and we're going to lose the audience if we don't cover the story. And I think, you know, even though we've got, you know, evidence in quotation marks that happened, I think there are definitely stories that have happened over the last few years, you know, in the wider world where people have gone, how did you know that?
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like, oh, I don't know how they could possibly figure that out.
Yeah.
Not like there's ever been something where that was figured out through a week before.
A lot of people think that News of the World was made like a fall guy so that the rest of the press could kind of continue doing whatever they wanted to do. But I think in the sort of, so in the Harry case, the only thing that's really relevant to the royals beyond just Harry is he's kind of revealed during this court case that Murdoch's company, News International, was supposed to apologize to William and Harry and they would kind of avoid a court case or delay a court case or something like that. They didn't apologize. And so I believe William and Harry, what's been alleged is that William and Harry were going to bring a case to kind of court, a civil case. And then William settled privately with Murdoch's company, whereas Harry moved to a new set of lawyers and continued his case. And that's what's gone to trial today. That's what a lot have made of that. But my view is that there is more than one way to get justice. And William and Harry both obviously had things happen to them that were violating and probably very awful and horrible. And I can imagine really screwed them up. And they each wanted kind of justice for that. But what justice looks like is different depending on the individual. And so I don't blame William for not wanting to go to court and for choosing to accept a settlement. I think a lot of people have been kind of implying that it means William loves the press. Showing your support for somebody by taking a significant amount of money from them is not, I don't really think that that's like siding with the press. Or like they've been implying that kind of there's some sort of conspiracy theories, you know, going around that basically is trying to paint William as being an evil person because he chose to accept the money and not go to court with Harry. And I think what we talked about a second ago of kind of like this was involving people all around William, and particularly his now wife. I can understand why he wouldn't want to go to court and then have to potentially talk on the stand about his relationship with his now wife. Especially because this was sort of 2005, they broke up in 2007, maybe, you know, some calls that never made it to the press were about things that they, you know, the relationship not going well or whatever. They don't want to necessarily talk about that. They don't want to bring it all up. And, you know, it's very valid for somebody whose livelihood does depend on the press to kind of not want to shake that relationship. Also not wanting to testify. You know, I think there's a lot been made of this idea that like the royals don't want to testify and it's because they've got all these deep, dark secrets and all that kind of stuff. But I think if you look at Meghan's case, she won that privacy case. And yet I don't think most people remember that she won. Most people remember that it was revealed that they'd collaborated with Omid Scobie on his book or that she misled a judge. That's the stuff people remember. It's not really the stuff that, you know, the fact that she won the case. So even if William had gone to court and had won, he might have said something on the stand or responded in anger and, you know, looked really bad or something that might have been the legacy of the court case, whether he won or not. So that doesn't mean that Harry's wrong for taking it to court. I'm not saying that necessarily, but I'm also just saying that like people make decisions about what's best for them for different reasons. And if I was in their shoes, I genuinely think I would probably just accept a settlement for it to go away so that I could move on with my life and not expose everybody around me to reminders of something that happened almost 20 years ago and was really, really difficult for us, you know?
Yeah. And I think, you know, I know Harry and William are public figures, and for a long time, you know, William is still, but for a long time they were both representatives of, you know, the British people, but that doesn't mean it's their duty to bring down the media empire. Like, they are victims of a crime, and they are, you know, and the civil court case, you know, is about sort of, is essentially, is there still a way to take, you know, get the money. It's still a way of getting money, it's just a more public way of doing it, and that's not wrong. And clearly for Harry, he's spoken about how for him, he sees this as his duty as someone in a privileged position to sort of make the press accountable. Whereas for William, you know, that, like you said, there are a multitude of reasons why someone might not want to do it. I wouldn't want to do it. I wouldn't want to go, it's, you know, and giving evidence, even in a case that you've brought, it's very traumatic. Like, you have to be cross-examined. People have to essentially stand there and be like, you're an idiot, you're a liar, prove it. And, you know, it is very hard to prove, especially for William, when it's, you know, his old friends who might not be friends with anymore, people who used to work for him, like his now wife. And we don't know how upsetting the phone hacking situation was for William or was for Kate. And if they hacked Kate's phone, I'm going to go out on a limb and say they probably hacked the other Middletons. And you don't know if that ever, you know, caused problems in their family. So maybe William sat there and went, yeah, I don't care, I'm just taking some money. Or maybe he thought, actually, I'm going to make a decision for my family and the impact it's had on them and the people I know, and just not take it to the press. And it's no more right or wrong than what Harry did. It's just a very different way of dealing with things. And it also is exactly what I would have done. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if there's that kind of American UK divide again, because mm-hmm. I think a lot of British people are like, yeah, I would also just take the money. And a lot of American people are like, no, you should stand up to the press.
Yeah. Well, we've said before, you know, in the context of the Andrew case, that the vast majority of civil cases that are brought don't go to court. And the majority has settled before. And that's not necessarily admission of guilt. It just means that the person recognizes the balance is not in their favor. And so they'll give you some money. And the person who's accepting the money usually thinks, well, this is easier than going through a whole trial when I could potentially lose. So I might as well just accept it. It's a risk assessment, essentially. And, you know, we've seen from the Harry case that Chelsea, his ex-girlfriend, has been brought up a lot because she was one of the people who was hacked. And it was a lot of conversations around their relationship that were in the press. And so, yeah, it would definitely bring Kate in. So I imagine it was sort of a joint decision between the two of them. And I, you know, I don't know if Harry told Chelsea or asked Chelsea's permission or anything like that. But I think it's that ripple effect of like, you being a public figure, William and Harry being a public figure, meant that the people who they care about around them were violated a long time ago. And I wouldn't want to be the person who does that again to them in a courtroom situation by bringing it all back up and making everybody think about it again. So that's, I think, yeah, neither of them is necessarily right or wrong. It's just different as to what they view as being an acceptable level of justice and what they prioritize. You know, is it this crusade against the press, or is it just being able to get on with my life and kind of recognize that whether I like them or not, I have to work with them. So I think I've got a sort of general point.
Yeah.
About kind of this whole situation, and kind of, I think there's a delicate balance between press and the royalty. They depend on each other. And I think the previous system of kind of deference probably wasn't sustainable, especially in the Murdoch era, with social media and all those kinds of things that were going on. I don't think that was sustainable, because the world has changed, and we are less likely to, I mean, well, if you look at just an average engagement, people would have curtsied a lot more in the old days than they do now. We're just generally less of a deferential society than we used to be. But I also think that the Murdoch era of kind of hacking everybody and doing all of these illegal things and constantly trying to get the most salacious gossip for everybody, that was also not a sustainable thing. And I think they weren't hacking, something that's important is that they weren't hacking phones to find out stuff that like was genuinely important to British society. If they'd been doing that, then we might have kind of gone, oh, well, you know, it might have been illegal, but we deserve to know, and they wouldn't have told us otherwise. But they were doing it for things like William's nickname for Kate, The story that exposed all of this with Tim Bradbury, that was a piece, a little piece in a gossip column on page 32 of the News of the World. It doesn't matter. Nobody cares that William was borrowing an editing suite from Tom Bradbury. And yet they were hacking people's phones to find out this completely unimportant, tiny little pieces of gossip. The public didn't deserve to know that William calls Kate Babykins. In fact, I think we shouldn't know that. Like, terrible. So actually, I know that I don't want to get into the court case too much, the current court case, but I think that he's probably right, Harry. His phone probably was hacked by more than just the News of the World. He probably was a victim. He might win, unless there's some sort of technicality. I think there's a good shot. But kind of going back to what I said earlier, I think as members of the public, we struggle with this situation so much because anytime a celebrity sort of talks about the press and you know, the coverage of them, it can feel like they're saying, I don't want any negative coverage of me. And Harry's brought lots of complaints to like Ipsos in the past, which he has lost because he was wrong. The press were fine to publish things that he said were terrible. So he's not always right about what is a violation and what isn't. And I think people really don't like kind of very privileged, very powerful people if it feeling like they just don't want, they want to have their cake and eat it too, I suppose, that they don't want any of the press coverage. They want all of the positive attention and none of the negative. And so my recommendation is that if Harry is talking about this situation, he talks about his kind of individual pain or the pain of like people around him, because that is very powerful. I think it was a violation and it was really terrible. And we tend to dehumanize celebrities quite a lot because they have the ability to go back home and comfort themselves with, you know, dollar bills or whatever in a way that we can't. So it's difficult for us to empathize with them. But this is not a historic fight for justice for the little person.
You know, one of the reasons I think Harry has found it, I don't say easy, but easier to go to court is because the people around him in the late 90s, early 2000s are not the same people around him today. Mm-hmm. So for him, you know, it's probably doesn't affect him as much if, you know, Chelsea, who, you know, he dated for a long time, is affected, because he's not married to Chelsea. He's, mm-hmm. you know, he's got a wife, he's got children, he's got a new life. And although I'm sure he's not going into this in the intention of causing pain to all of his naughties friends, you know, their happiness, people he doesn't talk to anymore, in his head, is probably not as high a priority as, you know, saving the world from the media, which is, you know, something he's always spoken about. And I think has become a cornerstone of a lot of his work since he's left the royal family. And I imagine it's going to be almost like his driving force going forward, that kind of, not attacking the freedom of the press, but changing what the freedom of the press means in his mind. Yeah. And I think the problem comes, particularly because he has such a multicultural life. Like, he was brought up as the essence of British, you know, in the British royal family, and now he lives in California and he spent a lot of time in Africa and he's married to an American, and, you know, his children will grow up American. And I think we view, you know, the press differently in different countries. Mm-hmm. And I think there's definitely almost a negative opinion of someone who is richer or wealthier being like, I'm doing this for the normal people, when actually, if it had been, you know, Millie Dowler's mother who'd gone up on that stand, the entire country would be, you know, waving flags and be like, team Millie Dowler's family, because they are little people themselves, you know, like, they're just normal people. And like you said, I think for Harry, that the sensible route forward, you know, is to be like, this impacted on me, like, me, my relationship broke up because of this, or you know, I didn't trust my I didn't go to the doctors because I was scared of this, and as an individual I have been harmed, rather than making it a crusade.
Definitely. I think that's a much more eloquent way of saying what I was trying to say. Thank you. This is my last paragraph in my notes, and so I was just like, add another thing, and this is what I want to say, and blah, blah. You know, I wasn't intending talking about Harry's case quite this much, but I have, so I'm going to keep going. I think that, firstly, we've all known that the royals' phones were hacked since 2006 when they pled guilty. So that's 17 years. We've all known for 17 years that the phones were hacked. And so many cases have come out since then. There's an entire group set up to supporting people who were hacked or who got hacked off, who, like Hugh Grant and that sort of thing, have been really big parts of. we've known about this. We've known that lots of people's phones were hacked, but nobody really cares that Hugh Grant's phone was hacked, or that Harry's phone was hacked, or that Sienna Miller's phone was hacked. And it's 17 years now, and still no one cares. And so I think that it is better for him to kind of humanize himself rather than trying to push this as something that like the little people all will really benefit from, because we've known for 17, like I feel like he thinks we're stupid and we need him to kind of come in and do the good thing because he's better and higher and loftier and smarter and all these things. And like, we've known for 17 years and we just don't really care. And also we're all intelligent. I mean, a lot of us are intelligent enough to be able to read the press and kind of go, oh, I don't think that's true. Or take things with a pinch of salt. We're not all brain dead morons who just read the press and are like, oh, well, that must be 100% true because it's in a newspaper. They wrote it down. There has to be, you know. And I think that he thinks that we're all living in this sort of world where none of us know that his phone was hacked and that none of us know the extent of the hacking. And if we all just knew what he knew, then we'd all be outraged by it. But we know what he knows and we're not outraged. And so I think that it would be better for him if he just focuses on the kind of him as an individual and how it impacted him and his family and how it still impacts him.
On the whole, the British public is not necessarily as sympathetic towards Harry as it would have been if he'd brought this case while he was still a working royal, for various reasons, some positive, some not so positive. And I think, you know, especially the fact he lives in America, and Britain has a kind of weird relationship with America where we quite like it, but also we don't like Americans telling us what to do. And there's that kind of like, well, you're not here anymore. You're not in the UK. You're not, doing British things. You're not working for the British public.
Yeah.
And I know, you know, in his sort of group of people, Doreen Lawrence is in there, who is, you know, a normal person.
Yes, and very admired.
But everyone else is a celebrity. So he's kind of brought this group with Doreen Lawrence, who I'm sure if she'd brought it by herself would have got all the positive publicity. But she's been overshadowed by the fact Harry's doing it, because no one's talking about the fact Doreen Lawrence is campaigning. But all everyone else, it's Elton John and his husband. It's, you know, Liz Hurley. It's rich, famous people. And it's taking up all the news coverage when there's, you know, not saying when there's wars on, but like there are wars on. And, you know, as a British public, we have royal fatigue, but we don't want to hear about them anymore. And the sympathy, I think that, you know, even in 2000 and, you know, 18, 19, 20 would have existed, just isn't there anymore. And I wonder if, you know, even if he'd, I don't say he should have waited, but if he'd waited a few years and let the news cycle move on, that sympathy might have come back if he'd come back in 2025 and said, this is actually something I really want to sort of push forward as an individual.
Yeah, especially because it comes right on the heels of his book and his other court cases. It kind of feels like it's all that he wants to do at the moment is just burn everything to the ground. And I can understand that impulse. I'm very much a burn your bridges kind of person. So I understand that. But I think, you know, it's just it coming all at the same time, it does feel like a lot. Also, in case people don't know, I just realized they were Doreen Lawrence, her son was murdered in a racist attack, and the police did not handle it very well and kind of covered it up for a long time, and it was horrific. And Doreen has now become, she's a member of the House of Lords, she's a campaigner for racial equality and against sort of police brutality and those sorts of things. So she's a really remarkable person, and it kind of goes back to that Millie Dowler group of like, or even Chelsea, who is not necessarily as sympathetic as Millie Dowler or Doreen Lawrence, but is an ordinary person who chose not to be part of the royal family deliberately because she wanted to be an ordinary person. And those are the people that are kind of being overshadowed in this a little bit. And that's not, again, it's not Harry's fault. Like, he can't help. You know, he's a victim as much as anybody else. So thank you for listening to our episode today. We're still very much playing it week by week because my access to Zoom might go away, and so we'll have to find somewhere else. So we're still playing it by ear. So who knows if we'll have an episode next week? Who knows if we won't? Ooh, the drama. But we had one this week and we hope you enjoyed it. And we appreciate all of our wonderful listeners. But other than that, it is a goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.